Chapter 51. The fury of the mammoth herd was more than Davin could have hoped for, the rumble of their retreat like an unending thunder that felt at times as if it might sunder the very ground they traversed. Just the sight of him as a giant sabre-cat sent the beasts into an uncontrolled panic. When he roared, panic gave way to the unthinking instinct all animals possessed to flee from danger. It also created a disorderly mess, a rolling flood of tusk, hide, and churning legs that he struggled to channel in a useful direction. Back and forth across the wide prairie west of Belshire he had loped, inspiring stragglers to better efforts and forcing those that wanted to run off in any other direction than southeast to correct their course. He couldn't keep them all in line, but if he could get half of them to Belshire, he reckoned it would be enough. The more wooded areas north of the city complicated things, but he was nearly there, sending the main clump of the mighty herd right down the road that led to Belshire's northern gate. It was early afternoon now. The noise of the herd's passing drowned out any sounds of the battle he hoped had not already been lost. The Cretesian army vastly outnumbered the force left behind to protect the city. Surely Ariane was well hidden, but if Key and Tar had followed his instructions, they would have taken her north, if the battle had tipped too far in the Cretesians' favour. While the road had made his herding task easier, it had doubled the dust, and he paused to ascend a nearby hill to get above the obscuring cloud. And there it sat, Belshire, a host of white tents around the northern side of the city. Nothing was burning inside the walls, though he had noted that the Cretesians seemed to want the towns and buildings intact, no doubt to use them after they occupied the territory. From his vantage point, it appeared that the army was marshalling in a field between their tents and the outer walls of the city. The orderly rows of tents were like a large white flag on a sea of green, their soldiers little maggots worming their way toward Belshire. Davin growled. It was time to give the Cretesians a nasty surprise. They wouldn't soon forget. He bounded off the hill. Without his continual prodding, the tired mammoth herd had slowed. Some animals foraging for leaves or sucking in water from the stream along the road and shooting it into their mouths from their long trunks. The time for refreshment and rest was over. He inhaled until his lungs felt fit to burst and let loose the longest, loudest roar he could muster, a roar he hoped would reach even the Cretesians' ears. And the mammoth bolted. Davin ran after them, letting loose with a deep bellow any time they slackened. The leaves and branches of the trees along the lane trembled at their passing. Then the trees gave way to open plains, and at last, like a pent-up flood, the herd burst into the enemy encampment. The meaty legs of the careening mammoth pulverized everything, tents, fires, and wagons, as if they were no more than brittle playthings. The herd's terrified trumpeting added to the din of their passing, and Davin's roars mixed with the scream of fleeing and dying men to create a cacophony he was sure would unman even the bravest of Cretus's soldiers. To keep up the pressure, Davin crossed back and forth across the herd as they fanned out, roaring to drive them into a final frenzy. The Cretesian army had turned away from Belshire, hastily forming their lines to face the bestial onslaught. The first line of guns fired, the bullets mostly serving to enrage the mammoth more. The second round fired, along with one of the cannons they had managed to reposition, one mammoth fell. And then the sea of hairy brown hide collided with a sea of white uniforms, the Cretesians scattering in every direction, only to be pounded, crushed, and broken. Calls for order were useless. Only pockets of men could form, but their attempts to blast the creatures only sent them careening in new directions to stomp on their allies. It had worked. Davin sprinted away again, turning any retreating mammoth back toward the Cretesians. Some of the enemy soldiers bolted for the city, taking their chances against the outmanned Bitomachian soldiers, but the bulk of these were blasted down by the men on the walls. Davin's heart leapt within him, but almost at once his happiness was cut down by something else, a feeling of dread that blunted his joy at his success. The screaming and yelling of frightened and dying men remained the same, but to his keen vision it seemed as if there was some shadow, taller even than the mammoth, that loomed large for a moment and then disappeared, only to reappear somewhere else. He wondered at the odd trick and the abysmal feeling that accompanied it, but was denied the luxury of analysis. Whatever the figure was, The mammoth must have sensed the terrifying feeling that had penetrated his heart, and they turned and ran north straight for him. While the herd's return journey did the Cretesians no favours, he had now become the victim of his own scheme. He roared to turn them. Still they came. He roared louder. They flinched, eyes wild, but still they came. The shadow rose and fell all over the field, the mighty shape of a giant man, scaring the lathering herd senseless. Just the presence of the shadowy form turned Davin's heart cold, and somehow he knew he had seen this shadow before, or perhaps not seen, but sensed it. The terrorized herd thundered right for him. He turned and ran, shooting back up the road just ahead of the stomping feet behind him. The dark feeling eased the farther he retreated from the city, the mammoth relaxing their pace. Paw after paw he ran until they were far behind, and then he angled off the road and into the shadow of the woods where the mammoth would likely not follow. Exhausted, he slowed to a jog and then to a walk. The fresh scent of oak and pine was a welcome relief from the smells of mammoth that had been a poor visitor for his sensitive nose for days. He turned toward a trickling stream where he stopped and drank his fill. What was the shadow that had turned the mammoth against him? But even more pressing, had the herd done enough damage to make the Cretesians abandon their designs, or at least delay their advance enough for the armies sent south to return and finish them off? As he swallowed another helping of water, a flapping bird landed on a rotted log that slanted into the water. It was a snowfinch, the one he had recently carved for key. It flitted onto his head, chirped in his ear, and then flew to the east, perching on a branch, as if waiting for him to follow. Despite the summer heat, Ariane pulled her cloak about herself while she leaned against the outer wall of one cinder pipe tavern. It was crucial that no one, friend or foe, recognize her. The Cretesians might be fooled by the concealment of her face, but any Bitomachian might guess that a mysterious woman travelling with Elaine Brighton, Key, Captain Gage, and 10 palace guards would likely be the queen fleeing the city. She imagined the disappointment her people would feel on learning of her abandonment would mirror her own. Leaving felt wrong and cowardly, but she had to agree with her advisers. The Cretesians would want to make an example of her, and her death would strike a demoralizing blow to the nation. As long as she was alive, she could rally her nation and take back what the Cretesians had won. Still, she wished they had the luxury of waiting until dark to keep the chance of discovery to a minimum. Fortunately, Mr. Goodwin seemed to know a good deal about the back ways of the city that kept them from the more crowded areas until they came to the northeastern edge of Belshire, a section of the town that was largely abandoned due to its proximity to the fight. The area was little better than the Crooks, but Mr. Goodwin knew exactly where he was going. Ariane peeked around the corner of the alley where they waited to see if they had made any progress. As it turned out, Mr. Goodwin also had a knack for opening locked doors. Now that his youthful transformation was complete, he was a handsome, dark-haired man. But no amount of youthful vitality could quite hide eyes or a tongue that seemed able to strip the skin off a man if he got cross. "You're in my light," he growled at one of the palace guards that watched over him, pushing him a step back to let the sun's rays fall on the lock into which he had inserted two small rods. "Curse that old Ben," he muttered as he worked the tools. "He's changed the lock again. I swear the man's as paranoid as I am." Ariane pulled a frightened Elaine to her side and wrapped her arm around her shoulders. The poor girl from a comfortable life wasn't quite ready for the upheavals of the past few days, and her eyes always seemed on the brink of tears. Ariane couldn't blame her, but if her sister started crying, Ariane thought she might just join in. "Why are we trying to get into a tavern?" Elaine asked. "Mr. Goodwin says it will help us escape," Ariane said, beginning to wonder the same thing. Davin had told her Mr. Goodwin had a fondness for strong drink, and while she hadn't seen him drink much, she hoped he wasn't wasting their time to stock up on spirits for the journey. The lock popped, and Mr. Goodwin stepped back and kicked the door open. "Tavern's open after all," he quipped, and stepped back to let everyone enter, nodding his head and extending his arm in an exaggerated flourish that brought a grin to Elaine's face. Ariane surmised he must have been a charmer in his younger days, which seemed to have blessedly returned to him. She stepped inside and wrinkled her nose, Elaine's grunt of disgust and Key's revolted expression a bit more demonstrative. The place stank of cheap beer, dirty sweat, and the backside of several animals put together. It was as low a place as she had ever seen. The tables were rough-hewn and coarse, and stains of every size and hue covered the floor. Whoever had left the tavern before it closed had done so in a hurry, half-filled mugs still sitting atop the tables. Mr. Goodwin chuckled and closed the door behind them. "It's not much," Mr. Goodwin said, "but it has what we need."
"And what is that exactly?" Ariane asked.
"A bolt hole," he said. "Now, come to this side room. Captain Gage, leave half your men in the main room just in case we are discovered. They may follow us in a moment."
"What's a bolt hole?" Elaine asked.
"Well, miss," Mr. Goodwin said, "it is a secret exit for people who need to leave a place in a hurry without being detected. The late Lord High Sheriff knew where most of them were, but I don't think he knew about this one." The side room Mr. Goodwin mentioned, which was really just a glorified booth, was separated from the common room by a dingy red curtain that Mr. Goodwin thrust aside. Straight-backed chairs covered in tooled leather surrounded a single round table that sported fewer dents and dings than the others in the establishment. Ariane wondered what the purpose of the booth was, besides a quick escape. "Captain Gage," Mr. Goodwin said, "if you would help me tip the table backwards." To Ariane's surprise, the table, which was supported by a single column of wood in the middle, swung over silently on a hinge, bringing up a square piece of the floor with it. A breath of earthy air filled the room, and Mr. Goodwin called for Captain Gage and his soldiers to find and light all the lanterns they could. Ariane peeked over the upturned table to find a hole descending into darkness, a rope ladder secured to one of the floorboards dropping down. "It's not as deep as it looks," Mr. Goodwin said.
"You've been through this bolt hole?" Elaine asked.
Mr. Goodwin coughed. "Yes," he said, looking away.
"What for?" Elaine pressed. Key smirked. "Yes, I should like to hear the tale." "We'll leave that for later," Ariane said,
Mr. Goodwin looking relieved.
"Where does the hole come out?"
"In a barn on the outskirts of town," he answered, taking a lantern from a recently returned Captain Gage. "It's at the foot of a hill and not far from the road that leads to Harwickshire. It's far enough out that it should get us past their patrols." Key stepped forward and glanced down the hole.
"And the elder forest there will be our trail. I think I have just enough mint to scent everyone from the predators, and even if the Cretesians find us, they won't wish to follow us inside."
Ariane nodded, noting the nervous glances of the soldiers. They weren't very excited about the prospect of traversing the dangerous elder wood in the dark, either. How had Davin lost his fear of the shadowy trees and predatory dangers? The elder wood at Harwickshire had thrilled her during the daytime, but passing through it at night would be another thing altogether. In the end, the soldiers scrounged up four lanterns, and it was decided that Captain Gage and five soldiers would descend first, followed by Ariane and her party, ending with the remaining five soldiers who would close the bolt hole behind them. It took a lot longer than Ariane expected. The coarse rope ladder bit into her palms, and no matter how secure her hands or her feet, she couldn't shake the feeling that she would fall off at any moment. Key and Mr. Goodwin descended as if they had practiced doing it their whole lives, but it took some coaxing to get Elaine down. The tunnel itself was barely tall enough to stand in and only wide enough for one person to pass through at a time. Once the remaining soldiers were down and the bolt hole closed, they marched forward single file along the damp pathway in the light of several low lanterns. Ariane could feel Elaine close behind her and wondered if her sister felt the same discomfort in the confining dark. After they had walked for only a few minutes, Ariane felt like screaming and digging her way out. The cool air, musty smell and cramped quarters had the feel of an old grave.
"How long does this go on, Mr. Goodwin?" Elaine asked.
"Not much longer, miss," he said, "though it is a good deal longer than most tunnels I've had the, opportunity to traverse." "Not much longer" seemed like an eternity, and by the time the lantern light fell on a narrow set of wooden steps, Ariane wanted to walk over everyone to get out first. At least it was steps instead of a rope ladder, she noted happily, though a couple of planks had gone missing and others were badly cracked. Captain Gage and his five soldiers went up the squealing, popping stairs first, throwing open a trap door and cautiously sticking their heads up. But the barn where the tunnel ended was free of danger, and in scant minutes they were all standing in the modest edifice and squinting into the light. Dust lay thick about the tools and the floor, the barn appearing to have had little use. Light streamed through cracks in the planks that formed the walls, while rays of sunshine slanted through holes in the crumbling roof. But there was something else, the sounds of battle, but with odd sounds mixed in with the regular rounds of rifle and cannon shot they had heard all day. It sounded like the trumpeting of Mammoth.
"Milady," Captain Gage said, "I will take a handful of men and scout about."
"I will go too," Key said.
Captain Gage furrowed his thick, dark brows in consternation.
"I would prefer—"
And then a roar broke through the air, a roar Ariane had heard before when she watched a massive sabre cat burst onto the drowning bridge and knock the soldiers to the ground.
"Davon!" she exclaimed. "Kodokim!" Key said with a grin,
and then she bolted out through the rickety door, leaving Captain Gage and his men behind. They left on their heels, and Ariane wrung her hands and paced the barn.
Davon was here. How would he find her? Was he in danger?
As if reading her thoughts, Mr. Goodwin spoke up.
"Aaron Carver's a sharp one, Your Grace. He'll make it through, though you might not want to tell him about that little clause in the Queen's will where he becomes king if he marries you."
They waited for nearly a quarter of an hour, the sounds of the battle rising to a frenzied pitch and then softening. The screaming of the terrified mammoth faded, and the gunfire subsided to sporadic pops. In their place came the wailing, moaning, and yelling of injured, frightened men. Even if distant, it chilled her heart. Elaine interrupted her pacing by grabbing onto her hand and leaning against her. The soldiers snapped alert at the sound of running feet, Ariane's heart leaping into her throat, but it was Key and Captain Gage and his men returning, eyes wide with wonder.
"It is strange," Key said, "but wonderful. I believe the Kodokim arranged a meeting between the Cretesians and an angry herd of mammoth, a trick he learned from Ta and me. The bird he carved for me has flown off toward the battle."
Ariane smiled. Davon had come through after all. Maybe she might forgive him just a little bit for deserting her again, though she really did owe him a reprimand or two.
"Captain," she said, "are the Cretesians done for? Can we go back?"
Captain Gage opened his mouth when the wooden snowfinch dove in through the door and alighted on Key's shoulder. A few moments later, Davon walked through the door, scruffy-looking and labouring. Ariane ran and embraced him.
"You can't go back, my love," he said in answer to her question. "Not yet."
She held him for many moments, and when she pulled away, her cheeks were wet. She wiped them with her sleeve.
"Why not?" she asked.
"They have been dealt a blow, but there is something dark at work here," he explained. "I'll tell you more along the way, but we need to get moving. Thank you, Key, for getting her this far."
Key nodded. "Let's get scented, and then I will scout ahead, brown man."